So I've been, the last couple of years after my master's degree, I've been actively pursuing conversations with atheists and engaging people about this topic. And when I talk to atheists, and you read atheist literature, the universe is their church. I wouldn't call atheism a religion, but it fulfills several things in the life of someone who is not a believer. It is aesthetically beautiful. It is scientifically rigorous. And current theories about the universe are solely without Christ. And so it's a very satisfying place intellectually for a lot of atheists to talk about. But I think Jesus, as the Lord and creator of the universe, has given us as Christians a unique language about the universe that we need to rediscover. And it's not to say that Christians have to become scientists. It's just a matter of recognizing and recapturing and remembering. Remember, Israel was always exhorted by the prophets to remember. And I think as the church, it does us well at this point in time to remember that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The heavens are the first created thing mentioned in the Bible. And the heavens are proclaiming. The Hebrew is a continuous, regular, ongoing verb. The heavens are proclaiming the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. And day to day pours forth speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. And I have books from my master's thesis that I've looked at, Christian and atheist alike, secular, up here about the speech that has poured forth about the universe, mostly from a secular perspective. The church has lost her voice when it comes to the universe. So David is contemplating the universe. Psalm 8, when I consider thy heavens, the works of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? I love what David says, the works of thy fingers. What kind of fingers makes moons and stars? You thought about that? I don't know if David is being poetic or literal, but either way, what's the implication of God making the universe with his fingers? It's no big deal, right? I can do it. But David is looking at the universe and he says, what am I? What is man that you are mindful of us? You know, we're pretty small, cosmically speaking. Why would God take notice of us and such small creatures as we? And why, even more so, would God become one of us? It's like us becoming an ant and going down into the anthill and telling ants how to do their business, right? That'd be pretty cool. Or maybe not. You just have to watch out for the feet, right? So the universe is all about the Lord Jesus. And I think secular science, there's this book. Most of you are probably old enough to remember Carl Sagan and Cosmos, the 1980 PBS series. This was a viewer's guide that was created along with the series. In the back of it is a historical timeline of the development of modern astronomy. And on the timeline, there's no mention of Christ at all, or his birth, or his resurrection. And I think that, by and large, represents the cosmos as we know it today, a largely secular interpretation of the universe without God, without specifically Jesus. Now, this event that we're going to be doing at Southwest is kind of the outgrowth of my thesis. And this is a theoretical physicist, Roger Penrose, who's no friend of Christianity. He was a co-laborer with Stephen Hawking. Everybody knows who Stephen Hawking is, right? He's the Cambridge mathematics chair, the gentleman who has, I think it's Lou Gehrig's disease, a rare form of it, who is probably one of the smartest men on the planet. Mr. Penrose worked with Dr. Hawking for a long time. But Mr. Penrose says this in a recent book that he just came out with, and I've got it up here if you want to take a look at it. Penrose is a really smart guy, and he's talking about, can fantasy, like fantasy, right, fantasy literature, have any genuine role to play in our basic physical understanding? Surely this is the very antithesis of what science is about and should have no place in honest scientific discourse. However, it seems that this question cannot be dismissed as easily as might have been imagined, and there is much in the workings of nature that appear fantastical. According to conclusions that rational scientific thought appeared to have led us when addressing sound observational findings. In other words, the universe is really weird, and it's like something out of the Lord of the Rings. It's so weird. Modern contemporary physics and cosmology have uncovered stuff we cannot explain. So when you read a book about the universe and it sounds like, you know, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson has it all together, he doesn't. We barely know what we're talking about. So That's the Milky Way. And that's a sign in a suburb of Brooklyn for an electrolysis specialist, hair removal. Now, what do they have to do with each other? Anybody have any idea what an electrolysis guy from Brooklyn and the Milky Way have anything to do with each other? Anybody want to take a guess? He brought them together. That sign is in an episode of Cosmos, in the beginning of an episode called The Backbone of Night, which was a whole entire episode about the Milky Way. And only Carl Sagan could get away with putting the Milky Way and electrolysis together in a video about the universe. And that's why people love him, because he could do that. In the opening of the scene, he's walking through his old childhood neighborhood in Brooklyn, the Bensonhurst District of Brooklyn, and he's talking about how he went to the library and got a book on stars. And there's that little scene, that little sign appears for about 3 seconds. And when you edit video, you know that every shot in a video scene is put in there deliberately. So there's room in the cosmos, in the Milky Way, for Sal Manuza. And that's what Carl Sagan could do. He could bring things together that were really weird, but when Carl Sagan brought them together, it was like universe sandwich. It was like chocolate and peanut butter. It was like grilled cheese. It was like all those things that at first seemed weird, but then they were like, yeah, that's really good. And that's what he was a master at doing. He could bring the heavens down to earth. But I think that's what the church needs to do, and I don't think that's what we are doing. So this is our first guest. Dr. Ward is a C.S. Lewis scholar. Probably knows Lewis better than Lewis knew Lewis. Michael has lived in the Kilns, Lewis's home. And he wrote a book called Planet Narnia, where he talks about what he uncovered about the Chronicles of Narnia. And I did my master's thesis on this book with Dr. Ward. He's very approachable, very intelligent, a wonderful man, and a delight to hear him speak. So he's going to be talking about Narnia, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Lewis understood the problems with modern astronomy. Way back in the 20s or the 30s, Lewis was writing science fiction. He was writing apologetics works. But Lewis well understood the problem with modern astronomy. What is the problem with modern astronomy? It looks at the universe as though the mathematics of the universe was all that mattered, that numbers emptied the universe of its personality, specifically Jesus. So we've come to understand the universe mathematically, but without reference to where did the math come from. So a lot of modern cosmology and astronomy deals with laws of physics, and these are great and it's wonderful, but these laws and these mathematics become the ultimate end of the universe. What's the universe mean? E equals mc squared. Is there more than that? What if we find an ultimate equation? Or is science just going to stop? So Lewis had a three-pronged approach that Michael's going to talk about in March. He was a professional scholar, a literary scholar, who he knew the 15th century, the 16th century very well. That's the century that Copernicus published his book about heliocentrism, or suggested the heliocentrics. Lewis was a popular apologist. He wrote apologetic works. Many of you probably know The Abolition of Man or some other of his works. And he also published fantasy and fairy tale. So Lewis, how many of you know that Lewis wrote a science fiction fantasy trilogy? People call it the Space Trilogy, but if you know Lewis, it's not Space Trilogy. It's called the Ransom Trilogy. Technically, Dr. Ward corrected me on that a long time ago. But Ransom is the main character in the novel. And Ransom, he goes and he single-handedly redeems the universe from the evil guys. And it's basically Lewis's interpretation of how to go about redeeming the universe. So Lewis approached the problem of the modern universe through his professional work, through apologetics, and through fantasy and fairy tale. So that's the fantasy, and he did it through the Ransom Trilogy, and he did it through Narnia. How many of you have ever read at least one book in the Chronicles? So there is cosmology in the Chronicles of Narnia. Have any of you heard of that thesis before? Lewis loved medieval cosmology, the medieval cosmology, and he used symbolism from medieval cosmology in his story to point to Christ. So Dr. Ward will talk about that in just a minute. Now, this is a quote from the London mayor. in September of 1939. What was happening in September of 1939 in Europe? Anybody know? What was Hitler doing? What did he invade? Poland, right? And so Britain knew he was coming, right? Now, at the time, the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, had, you know, peace in all time. He thought he had signed a peace document with Hitler. Oops. So the London mayor was a little bit more savvy than his boss, and he decided to start an order to evacuate London. And this is kind of where it boiled down to. I'll put on a British accent here to give you more flavor. He says, "Look, Oris," that was Prime Minister Neville's assistant, "go in there and tell Neville this is from me. If I don't get the order to evacuate the children from London this morning, I'm going to give it myself and tell the papers why I'm doing it. How will his nibs like that?" Half hour later, Morrison had his document and the evacuation that began that afternoon. That was the beginning of Operation Pied Piper. I misplaced. There we go. So 3 million children, people, evacuated London in the fall of 1939 based on that order. And you're looking at a picture of Operation Pied Piper. All the children were separated from their families and sent to the countryside to be adopted by people so that when the Luftwaffe came over Britain, the children would be safe. That's what's inspired Lewis to write the opening of the Chronicles of Narnia. Does anybody know the opening of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Well, let me see if I can get it. No. I didn't put it in here. Well, anyway, the opening is that the four school children arrive at the professor's house. Well, that really happened to Lewis, because Lewis actually received part of some four schoolgirls from that Operation Pied Piper at his house. And here's a letter to his brother describing how they loved the weird professor. They came to the weird professor's house. So there's some real truth in that. But Lewis takes The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and uses it as a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale. Somebody say it's an allegory. It's a Christian allegory. Not really. It's more of like a fairy tale. Suppose here's what Christianity would look like with just a twist of an imagination to it through this genre of fairy tale. And he thought that what he wanted to do was give people a taste of Christianity through fairy tale. And so this is the medieval cosmos. And if you notice how many, there's seven planets in the medieval cosmos. And there's seven planets, seven of them, they include the sun and the moon. But each of the planets were believed to exert an influence on the events on Earth. So this is kind of getting into the astrology-astronomy issue before astronomy and astrology split. And really what Lewis was doing was taking the planetary influence. This is where we get astrology. Astrology and astronomy used to be one and the same discipline until 1500, 1600, when astronomy went this way and astrology took on the negative connotations that it has today. So if you, in the medieval astrology astronomy, the planet Jupiter was believed to influence you. So when Jupiter was close, and this is, we're getting into astrology, but I want to clear up that Lewis was not actually doing this. But if Jupiter, the planet Jupiter, was close to Earth, it would influence a jovial, kingly, gift-giving kind of influence. Now, Lewis didn't really believe that's what the planet Jupiter did. He was not ascribing astrology to the planets. What he was doing is he took all that, he put it into a story, and made that as the personality of the main character, who is? Who knows who's the main character in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Aslan. Aslan, I think, is how they pronounce it. So Lewis put all of those characteristics into Aslan in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then ultimately all of those characteristics in Lewis's imagination don't point to just Aslan, they point to Christ himself. So Lewis takes pagan astrology, baptizes it, and raises it in newness of life, using it as signs and symbols to point to Christ. So Lewis is not doing astrology, he's taking astrology and using it in a way that he believes God intended it. So the planet Jupiter, what do we know that to be typically today? What do we call Jupiter? The king of the planets. And so Lewis was taking all that imaginatively and throwing it into Narnia. And Dr. Ward's going to talk more about that during his broadcast. Okay. So it's triple meaning. You have medieval cosmology, you have the character of Aslan, and then you have all of it pointing to Christ. So Lewis used all that, baptized it, and pointed to Christ. So all of Aslan's characteristics. So there's seven books. So each of the books represents one of the seven planets. So each planet's medieval influence is in Aslan, which Lewis believes also points to Christ. So this is what Lewis believed, that when you see the planet, right, it's like, oh, it's breathtaking. And so the medievals would take that breathtaking sense and put it into meaning on Earth. And then today, the planet still influences us. NASA just spent several billion dollars sending a probe to Jupiter, the Juno mission. And it's going around Jupiter, and it's lots and lots of taxpayer dollars going around and taking pretty pictures of a planet. So it's still wielding an influence. And in fact, when Juno sent back pictures of Jupiter from its arrival, the director of the project, Scott Bolton, showed at the public release, Juno had captured a motion picture of the four moons, the Galilean moons, going around Jupiter, and described it as the first time in history anybody actually seen that happen, and described it as the king with his disciples going around it. So even a modern NASA specialist cannot help but use that kind of language in describing the universe. This is our second guest, Dr. Kokemoer. He's worked for the Space Telescope Science Institute for over 20 years. Dr. Kokemoer has 500 peer-reviewed papers, and he's authored, he is the chief guy, the chief photographer, if you want to think of it that way, who imaged the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And let me see if I can get a picture of it here. Do, 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 do. Sorry about this. Okay, does everybody have a penny? Who does not have a penny? How far did the pennies get?
Where's the jar of pennies? Who stole the jar?
Who doesn't have a penny?
Oh, there they stopped back there.
Who doesn't have a penny?
Let's go around the room.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and who needs one? Where's the jar? Pennies? Everybody has one? Oh, we needed this row. Okay. So everybody, I want you to take your penny and look at the Eye of Lincoln. Hold it up to the ceiling now. All the way, elbows extended. How many eyes of Lincoln would it take to cover the ceiling of the sanctuary? Did I just ask an imponderable question? Okay, so put them down again. Take a look at the eye. We can get a number, right? I don't know if we can get a number. We're just in the sanctuary. Okay, so pause that thought for just a second. This is our neighbor, Andromeda. So if we run out of sugar in the Milky Way, we have to go 2 million light years to get sugar from Andromeda, if we have anybody living there that makes sugar. I don't know if they have Hawaii or... But anyway, that's Andromeda. That's our closest galactic neighbor. So if you turn a flashlight on where the star is, it takes 110,000 years for that flashlight to get to the other side of the galaxy. That's how big that galaxy is. And light travels at 186,282 feet per second, 82 miles per second. So light traveling as fast as it does would still take 110,000 years to go across Andromeda. They've got about 10,000 light years on us. We're about 100,000 here in the Milky Way. So that is what Anton has taken a picture of. Anybody know what that is? That's the Hubble Extreme Deep Field. What you're looking at, with the exception of that little guy who photobombed the thing, that's a star in the foreground, those are all galaxies. Each one of those are galaxies. Now, the Hubble Space Telescope goes around the Earth every 90 minutes. And every 90 minutes, it took a picture of this spot of sky 400 times. No, 800 times, excuse me. 800 times. So Anton went through all 800 images of this spot in the sky and collapsed them together for public release. Anton is a believer. I met him after a conference presentation that he gave in Houston. And afterwards, we were having tea and cookies, and Anton was standing out in the lobby being grilled by an atheist who said, "How can a Christian work on the Hubble Space Telescope?" And this is where our culture is today. They think that Christianity and faith are irreconcilable with modern science, let alone astrophysics. Okay, so I want you to do what the prophet Isaiah did one more time. The prophet Isaiah said in Isaiah 40:26, "Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars." So go ahead and lift up your eyes on high again, up to the ceiling. Can you see Lincoln's eye from that? It's hard to see Lincoln's eye at arm's length, isn't it? So did anybody come up with a number of how many Lincoln's eyes would cover the sanctuary? Okay, so what's this Lincoln's eye all about, guys? Well, that's the spot of sky in which that was taken. That 10,000 galaxies in the spot of sky no bigger than the eye of Lincoln on a penny held at arm's length. How many would cover the ceiling? How many would cover the skies above Tyler, Texas? How many would cover the skies over Texas, over the United States? How many eyes of Lincoln would it take to surround the earth? And that's, now look at the top of your penny. What does it say? Now you can do pocket evangelism with pennies. You know, by the way, right? And Anton has been working with this stuff for years, 20 years, and he's a believer. And so Anton gives presentations about what he does to the public. So the question that God asks all of us, as he asked Job, do we know the ordinances of the heavens? Not really. This image just paradigmatically changed our conception of the universe. Astronomers are like, well, we thought there was this many galaxies, and now we just don't know. You know, it's like a Wonderful Life, you know? It's like, whoa. Yeah. Now, so these are some of the weird images that Hubble has taken over the years. This is what is technically known as SN1987A. It was a supernova that went off in 1987, and this is imaged by the Hubble Space Telescope. And this was a star that exploded. That's what supernovas do. And this comment from a secular astronomer written in 2007 demonstrates the mystery that we're dealing with in the cosmos. Supernovas are supposed to be pretty well understood, but this one that popped up still baffles astronomers. Nobody has any idea why it did that. But we have the Hubble Space Telescope that can give us that image and make astronomers scratch their head. That's one exploded star. And you're just like, what? Right? So it thinks of Roger Penrose and the fantasy quote at the beginning, right? That's the stuff that you might see in The Lord of the Rings or Chronicles of Narnia. By the way, I'm just lecturing. Does anybody have any questions at this point? I'm just rambling. It all makes sense in my head. If it doesn't make sense in yours, please raise your hand and ask me a question. How does this all tie together, Dan? What did you just say? Can you back up to like the beginning? Sorry, it's just overwhelming for me. So please, is there any questions at the time? I'll just stop myself. Shut up, Dan. Anybody have any questions or are just interested to hear me ramble? Okay, that's great. So that's a supernova. That's one. And this is my favorite. You can see this in a telescope. This is the Great Globular Cluster in the constellation of Hercules. 300,000 stars. 300,000 stars. That's just one tiny globular cluster. There's red suns and blue suns and yellow suns and orange suns. And as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:41, star differs from star in glory. Well, there you go. I can see that in my telescope. And the French comet hunter, Charles Messier, the 18th century guy who he was known as the comet ferret. He would put his telescope up there and he was looking for comets. And so he ran into these objects in his telescope. These objects were kind of fuzzy because he didn't have very good, you know, resolution on his 18th century telescope. So he thought these were balls of fuzz. They weren't comets. So he made a list of things that you should ignore. So I'm looking for comets. This is not a comet. I will write this down and I will go on through the next thing. And so he made this. This made the list. This is M13. This is the 13th object on Charles's list. Do not pay any attention to this number. It is not a thing to see. And when he wrote it down, when he found M13, he said, there are probably not any stars in it. So that is just kind of an example of how scientific paradigms can change with, you know, viva la resolution, right? This is an Einstein's cross. This is something that Anton studies. Now, this is a very interesting phenomenon. That's a real image from the Hubble Space Telescope. That little cross is called an Einstein's cross. And that's a real image. That's a supernova. And what it is so like there's a supernova on that wall, and the Hubble is looking from that wall. And in between the walls is like a giant mattress with a bowling ball on it. But it's translucent. You can see through it. So the light from that supernova goes through the mattress bowling ball configuration. So the light from that supernova, can you see? I can't even get an earpiece right, and I'm talking about supernovas. There we go. So the light from that supernova goes through the mattress bowling ball configuration, and Hubble picks it up. So what does the mattress bowling ball configuration represent? Well, the mass, just stuff. So what's going on there, and I'll get back to this one, is there's the bowling ball, and if you could look top down through the bowling ball on the mattress, that's what you'd see. So the mass of the fabric in front, the mass of that galaxy warps the supernova light. So the supernova is one light going through the mattress of mass, and it translates into four different pictures of the one event into the lens of Hubble. And that's what this is. Now, you remember the galaxies that I showed you, the Anton's picture? That is a mass globular cluster of galaxies. Now, that's a cluster of stars. That's impressive. That's a cluster of galaxies. That is a cluster of galaxies. A cluster of galaxies. Now, you see the faint lines around the edge? That's the gravitational mass of all of those galaxies, like a bunch of bowling balls sitting on a mattress. It warps the mattress fabric, all that mass. But it's a mattress you can see through. So any light behind it goes through that mass and is distorted. All of that light that you see ringed around the edge is light from behind that galaxy cluster. And so what Hubble... Yes, sir? Well, the mass, it's like... I'm trying to explain it. The mass is not something... It's like me, you know, my body weight. It's the fabric of space-time, I guess you can say. That you... It's good. It's not nothing. You know, on Earth we call it weight, but the weight of the the weight of the stuff, of the galaxies is made of stuff, the weight of that warps space-time fabric, the fabric of space-time. So you think of galaxies just sitting on fabric of some kind, like nylon or stretchy material or something like that. We really don't know, I really don't know what it is. But the galaxy's mass sits on this space-time fabric, and this fabric is what is being stretched out, and it's what warps the light from behind it, if that makes any sense. I'm not a cosmologist, but I've listened to Anton tell me this a few times, and I tried to get it right. But anyway, why Anton, this is interesting, is because Anton's field work, those galaxy clusters are targets for the new telescope that's going up in 2019, the James Webb. And so the James Webb is going to look at something like that and try to see the light from beyond that. And so here's another Einstein's cross. Now, it's interesting to me, I don't know what the Lord was doing here, but it's interesting to me that the death of a star produces a cross-like shape. So we're going to have a really interesting conversation in Fort Worth in March with a Hubble astrophysicist and a C.S. Lewis scholar. Now, I want to read something from C.S. Lewis that epitomizes what Lewis was up to and I think what the church is kind of a clarion call. All of us are sort of, everybody feels average. There's no, how many of you feel like super extraordinarily wonderful, like you're up to doing some great work? I don't. I don't know why I'm doing this. I live in Poolville in a barn with mice. And I somehow this fell into my lap. But this is a picture of Michael Collins. Who knows who Michael Collins is? Michael Collins was the guy that got to ride the Apollo lunar orbiter as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin got to land on the moon. Michael drove the vehicle that picked him up. And so this is kind of a modern version of Psalm 8. Remember Psalm 8 I read at the beginning? So this is Michael's breakfast before he gets launched to the moon. Proper expression, wouldn't you think? He's kind of got, well, here I am, a white male, age 38, height 5 feet 11 inches, weight 165 pounds, $17,000 per year. I live in a Texas suburb with a black spot on my roses, state of mind unsettled, about to be shot off to the moon. Yes, the moon. And I think as average citizens of the kingdom that the Lord calls us to do extraordinary things, but part of that calling includes recognizing our clay, right? 2 Corinthians 4, 6, and 7. We have this treasure within us, within clay jars, so that we may know that the power resides in Christ, resides in God. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but that if God calls you to something extraordinary, he's going to first make sure that you're well aware this is not you, it's not about you, but it's about him. And I feel like when we go after, the way to redeem a culture is to be the people that God has called you to be extraordinary in what you do, and you just never know what God's going to do. You never know what story he's going to tell through you, and you never know how he's going to use you, because this universe is like a fantasy story, and you all have a part to play. The psalm says, David says in the psalms, you, all of, in your book, all the days were written, ordained for me, when as yet there was none of them. And so, how many of you are familiar with the character of Puddleglum in The Silver Chair? Puddleglum is like a scarecrow web guy that lives in the swamp. Lewis wrote the character after his depressing gardener, Paxford. Paxford was very depressed and pessimistic about everything. But Paxford would always do the right thing. And so in the Puddleglum, goes down to Underland with the children, and he confronts the Green Witch, which is a representation of the scientism and the materialism of the modern world. And she's telling them that the universe of the above land is all an illusion. And Puddleglum refuses to believe that and puts his webbed foot in the fire and causes a little bit of pain, but heroically stamps out the green fire that makes everybody kind of sleepy. He does the heroic thing, even though he doesn't seem like the guy that's going to do the heroic thing. And that certainly feels like me a lot of times, where you feel like, you know, what does the universe have to do with me? What do I have to do with anything? What can God possibly do with me? You know, one of Peter's first reactions to Jesus coming to him was, "Depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." Have you ever felt that before? You know, when Jesus comes to you, it's like he deals with your stuff first, right? And that's very hard. But then he does a wonderful thing, and he takes you, and despite your stuff, he still works through you. And that's what is amazing to me, is that God seems to do that repeatedly. So I'm all over the map right now. This is the first time I've ever put something together like this. And so you guys are really the first audience that has seen this. One thing I want to conclude on, and then we'll do some question and answer discussion stuff. I wanted to leave plenty of time for that. This is going back to Carl Sagan. How many of you know what that dot is? Anybody want to take a guess? I have a prize. Earth. All right, Chris. We'll go. I did not arrange that. No, I had a little astrophysics book. But I was going to build up a little bit more with that. But anyway, that didn't work out very well. Just for time, I was like, huh. A week from today, next Wednesday, will be what day? Valentine's Day, right? On Valentine's Day of 1990, the satellite Voyager 1 from several billion miles away, very far away, Carl Sagan was instrumental in having Voyager's camera was going out to the solar system. It was, you know, doing this way, and Carl Sagan said, "Hey guys, why don't we turn it around and take one last shot of our solar system?" That was going to be very expensive, but he lobbied for that, and that's what happened. Voyager 1 turned around slowly, took a picture of all the planets of the solar system before it left our solar system. That is a selfie of Earth. From some many billion miles away. And it came back to Earth on Valentine's Day of 1990. And Carl Sagan is probably most famous for his quote called, if you Google this when you go home, "Pale Blue Dot." Well, that's what it is. That's us. And it's really interesting how Sagan interprets who we are on that dot. Read that. Is that true? Is that a scientific conclusion? It's not. But that is the epitome right there, ladies and gentlemen, of the modern secular cosmological astronomy that's going out there and being sold to the general public. That's what we are in a cosmos without Christ. We are just a thin film of life on an obscure and solitary lump of rock and metal. The only thing that's scientific about that statement is the rock and metal. Everything else is Sagan's interpretation. Now, why would Sagan interpret mankind that way? Does anybody have any idea? Why would he do that? He doesn't. And that's remarkable. Yes, that when God created the heavens and the earth, and he made that, he knew what would happen when he came to that. It was an act of love. It was an act of suffering. I'd never thought about it before, but as I was thinking about it, creation could very well be considered an act of suffering and an act of love. Because it's like marriage or raising children. You know what you're getting into, kind of.
I don't know if you saw it, but the only thing David Smalley added to that night when we did the talk up here was what he said was the thing, quote, closest to an atheist prayer, which is the pale blue dot speech.
That's right, Pastor. I remember him saying that. Yes, the pale blue dot is the closest thing to an atheist prayer. As I said in the beginning, the cosmos is the closest thing to atheist church. So let me forward this. Now, this is what's really interesting, that Sagan, in the book called Pale Blue Dot, where is it? I have the book up here somewhere. Anyway, in the book, The Pale Blue Dot, I can't believe it's gone. What did I do with it? Anyway, it's really interesting. He says this. He feels like he has to qualify this statement. Because of the reflection of the sunlight off the spacecraft, that's where that sunbeam came from, by the way. It was a reflection of sunlight off the Voyager spacecraft. He says, because of the reflection of the sunlight off the spacecraft, the Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light, as if there were some special significance to this small world. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. That's not a scientific statement. But that he has to qualify. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, it seems to see that God may set that up so we can see ourselves, you know, but to qualify by the way, the beam of light, that's just an accident. You know, because he went out of the way to qualify that, what does it make you think? You know, no, the idea that we're going to turn the spacecraft around and take a picture of Earth, and just so happens that we get a sunbeam so we can see the Earth. But that's the kind of cosmology that we're dealing with today. Now, this is a astrophysicist, James Binney, and this was going to be what I tied into the book, but I just blew that, but anyway. Now, this is James Binney describing what goes on in the heart of stars. He says, atoms whiz about, they violently collide, electrons are knocked out, nuclei collide, bodies repel one another, collisions are so violent that some nuclei actually touch. So there's violence, there's collisions, there's whizzing about. Without Christ, how do you describe the atomic heart of stars? How do you describe the universe without God? How do you describe how atoms come together to create nuclear energy? Is it better to say collisions and violence and random whizzing about, or was it all purposely arranged in that capacity? That's the kind of subtle language that you see in science. I'm not saying atoms don't come together. I'm saying that do we have suns and stars and people because of atoms just randomly coalescing together without sentient intelligence guiding them and putting them where they need to be? I don't know what James believes, but that's the overriding language of secular cosmology. If there's no Christ, you have to come up with something else for all this wonder and awesomeness that we see in the universe. For by faith we understand that the universe was formed by God's command, so that what was seen is not made out of what was visible. And Christ has first place in that. So Anton and Michael, I hope, and this is Lawrence Krauss. He's written a book called A Universe from Nothing, where a very intelligent astrophysicist equivocates about the word nothing. On and on and on and on. And he gets mad at people who call him out on it. But that's what he believes. The universe literally came out of nothing. And he says in so many ways, the world we see is an illusion. I have another book by a Stanford physicist, Leonard Susskind, in the title of his book, The Cosmic Landscape and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. So it's very much on the forefront of scientists' minds. They're just trying to dismiss it all as illusory. There is Betelgeuse. That's in the constellation Orion, which you can see when it's clear in this time of year. That star is 1 billion miles in diameter. 1 billion miles in diameter. I don't even know what that to compare that to. What do I compare? Driving back to the Metroplex seems like 1 billion miles to me. That's just one star, you know? And this is the Metroplex. Now, what this is very interesting. This is light pollution. It looks like somebody just threw mud at the Metroplex, doesn't it? Which is probably what you guys do in East Texas anyway. But that's people in Dallas and Fort Worth, literally, that's sky blindness. They can't see the stars. That's what that means. Now, in this small book, this is Neil deGrasse Tyson, the popular astrophysicist. Everybody know who Neil is? Does everybody know who Dr. Tyson is? The chair of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, popularizer. He's remaking Carl Sagan's Cosmos. It's coming out again next year. He's a wonderful science communicator. He's a great guy. But in this little book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, Dr. Tyson uses these words to describe the universe. Collide, mess, warped, burst, spawned, violent, collision, strewn hither and yon, escaped, blobs, adrift, mayhem, flotsam, ammo, exploded, smithereens, homeless, cannibalism, ripped apart, consumed, corpses, eaten, junk, monstrous hazard, death, suffocated dangers, and seething. All in this little compact book for people in a hurry. Well, what does that say about our universe? That is a universe. That's the language of a universe without a creator. Doesn't seem like a very nice place to be, or it seems like Interstate 20 when it's under construction. All right, I think I've wrapped up everything that... So I've talked about Dr. Kokomor. I've talked about the overall gist of what we're trying to... conversations we're trying to start. And many of you, there's a lot of secret atheists that live in and around Bible Belt communities. I've talked to a lot of them. We've talked to David. There's a lot of atheists that are... that when you talk to them and you get to know them and you get to listen to them, this is what they love. They love the universe. And so part of this isn't just an academic exercise for fun and entertainment. It's like developing a language to be able to speak to unbelievers and atheists, because this is their church. This is kind of their religion. This is their prayer. This is their hope. It's science. It's beauty. And it's explanations without Christ. So we got 10 minutes. Questions, comments? I've got books up here you can look at, and I can tell you all about, and everything from how to look at stars in your backyard to fine-tuning of the universe. So thank you for the opportunity to speak here. This is the first time I've really spoken to a group like this, and I hope I've made at least some sense. I apologize for my rambling, because that's what I do. I'm used to it. Oh, they're used to you rambling? Is that what it is? Okay, so good. That's good. All right, questions. I'm going to stop. Comments. If you just want to comment. Yes, sir.
I was wondering
if you could share your thoughts on the creation. Does God organize matter, or is it like a Big Bang theory, or kind of your view? That's an excellent question, because, do physics operate by themselves, or are they sustained by Christ in an ongoing fashion? Is that kind of what you're getting at? Does God set up the universe and let it go? Or does he intervene in every moment? And I think one of the best scriptures that I can... There's several, but I think there's one scripture that talks about a sparrow falling to the ground and dying. That doesn't happen apart from the will of the Father. And then I think in Colossians as well, in Colossians 1, Genesis, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians. There we go. Philippians, Colossians. All right, thank you. Yes, for by him all things were created, both in the heavens and the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created by him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So somehow he holds it all together, moment by moment. The verse that I quoted from Isaiah, in Isaiah 40:26, one commentator said that God calling forth the stars by name is something he does every day. But details, we really want to know, where is God in all the physics? But I think he's there in every way. We just, beyond our ability to comprehend. So I think Isaac Newton, when he developed his laws of gravity, that's when God sort of became separated from the equations, if you will, that God set up gravity and laws, and then just kind of sat back and said, you know, like we build cars, and people who build cars don't have to ride with us to keep them going. But the idea that God is an intervening God constantly is somewhere where I fall on that he's upholding everything, because that makes it personal for me. He's upholding my blood and guts too, and bringing me to Tyler and Pastor Chris and, you know, putting me on atheist shows. And so it gives me comfort that God is in control. The flip side of that is that God is not in control. It's just kind of, yeah, go ahead, Dan, try. Yeah, I'll be over here in the corner when you need me. So I hope that answers your question. At least I give you my opinion. Yes, sir. So you're basically, if I'm hearing you right, they start from the modern assumption of Big Bang Theory, that current science says the universe had a beginning. Right. Yeah, so William Lane Craig especially will be a proponent of this. And I think it's very interesting that there is a similarity between modern science conceptual ideas of the beginning of the universe, which is cosmogony formally, and what we have in Genesis. But the field of cosmology is a very young discipline. And science is a very abstract, formal discipline. It's only, you know, been in the West for about 500 years. So my personal belief is that I would start with Genesis, and that Genesis doesn't need science to validate it. But there's nothing wrong with taking the language of the modern science, the modern scientific secular sciences, and saying, boy, guys, isn't that really kind of weird how it kind of measures up with Genesis? And I think that's what Bill Craig does, taking advantage of how God seems to turn even the secular mind back to this concept of a beginning, because we've discovered that matter and energy are really poor candidates for existing forever. You know, so they have to have come into existence at some point. But I would start foundationally with Genesis. I just find it a wonderful divine quirk that God has tuned the sciences toward the idea of a beginning, which is reprehensible to a lot of cosmologists. We want to try to get around this. So Lawrence Krauss will just say things like, well, the universe had a beginning, but it just came out of nothing, right? So, yeah, it's troublesome, and it's really there, and they're trying to find ways around it. But, yeah, it seems to be the thing right now, right? But I wouldn't, and I don't think Bill Craig does this, I wouldn't say, see, modern science backs up Genesis. No, because some brilliant physicist can come along and say, no, here's what happened, right? And then all that's out the window, and we're back to square one again. Well, what happened to Genesis? Well, it's always. So that's kind of where my brain's at on that. Anyone else? In the booth. Yes, it's far beyond my pay grade, and basically it's what Lawrence Krauss calls nothing. It's a quantum vacuum. It's not something that Hoover or Dyson sells you, but it's an airless thing. It's like a magic pot where particles pop into existence and come in and out of existence. And Lawrence believes that in this magical quantum nothingness, the particle can pop into existence and create a universe. It's like putting popcorn in your skillet. Does anybody do popcorn in a skillet anymore, or do we just do it in a microwave? Putting your microwave popcorn and expecting one of them to turn into San Francisco. That's the gist of the theory. It's basically a universe pops into nothing, and it's just like the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, there it is. It wasn't there Tuesday. What happened? That's basically the gist of it. Anybody else have any other questions about... Well, there was a guy named Halton Arp back in the 50s and 60s, I think it was. And he proposed that the way we measure the expanding of the universe is redshifts, right? So you've all heard the train, or a siren. And when you hear it, that's kind of the, in light, that's the blue, that something is moving towards you. When you hear that, that is in the spectrum of light, that's light moving away from you, that's red. So a lot of the stuff in the universe, we're at the end of it, where it's red, and everything we see is red. And that means it's redshifted. That means it's moving away from each other. But there was a guy in the 50s and 60s named Halton Arp who was basically, on a professional level, crucified for suggesting that the redshift means something else other than distance or speed. He was literally thrown out of, he couldn't publish, but he's got some good points, and I read it. But the reason that we think the universe is expanding is because of the redshifts of most of the stuff that we see. So you can look at a galaxy and see that it's redshifted in the infrared lower wavelength of the electromagnetic spectrum. And that tells us, at least theoretically right now, that stuff is moving away from us in every direction. Andromeda, by the way, is coming at us. So in a few million years, we will have a collision. I want to be around for that. I wonder, it would be hard to imagine, you know, what that's like, especially like, it's like snow days in Texas, right? It'd be one of those things on a larger scale. But they say when galaxies collide that there's so much space in between them that they probably wouldn't touch anything. So I don't know, that'd be interesting. But yeah, that's kind of how they think right now. And it's kind of weird because if it's true, what's going on is that galaxies are moving faster than the speed of light. And it's not the light that's moving, it's the stuff the galaxy is sitting on that's moving faster than the speed of light. We don't know what that is, and so they call it invisible dark energy. It's just a placeholder we don't know that's accelerating stuff like freight trains from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. And we don't even know what it is. Because if the redshifts are right. So if you imagine a fully loaded truck sitting at a stoplight with you, and it's fully loaded, and it's an 18-wheeler, and he's like 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. You got to posit some kind of super force of an energy. And that's basically that 18 rigs sitting next to you at the stoplight is basically what the galaxies are doing right now. How did that truck go from 0 to 60 that fast? There's not enough time for a truck to go 60 miles an hour in 5 seconds. But there is stuff moving so fast in our galaxy that 14 billion years is not enough time for it to have accelerated to the point that it is. So astronomers are going, something's wrong. We don't know. We just don't know. And I'm not saying that, well, we don't know, therefore Jesus. I'm saying Jesus, therefore we don't know. It's not God of the gaps. It's my brain of the gaps. Any other questions or comments? I'm going to be here for a while, up here talking. This will conclude the formal time, but I'm here for the night, and I'll be here in the morning for breakfast. I will be up here for small talk if you want. Your call.
Is this one on mic? There we go. Hey, so obviously if you've got kids or whatever, you need to go pick them up. We'll take some time to put up tables and chairs. Yes, Lance? We doing tables and chairs for Sunday? But Dan has graciously said he's going to hang out, drink coffee, sit and talk if anybody wants to, kind of as late as anybody wants to sit and chat. If you're interested in buying him breakfast tomorrow morning. I have a really short window, so I'm going to in the short window I have, unless somebody else says, "Hey, that'd be a lot of fun. I'd like to take."
Or they could join
Dan.
You and I.
Or they could, yeah. I'll be there only for a little while, but anyway, Liz, I was telling when Dan was like, "Do you think really people are going to be interested in any of this?" And I said, "This is a church full of nerds. Like, there are a lot of nerds here, and so." This is something that you will have people interested in. If you are, send me an email if you are interested. The website for where to schedule? Yeah, it's up there. For the event. If you want to register, do so. And if you would like to caravan or ride in the bus, send me an email and let me know ASAP that you want to do that for that event. Obviously, it'll be a late night, I guess, for us, because we'll be coming. It's Lynn's at 9. We'll be coming back 2.5 hours. To get back sometime around that time. But if you can do that, that's awesome. Again, hang out with Dan here as long as you would like to. And then if you come up and say, "I want to meet you for breakfast," then y'all just let me know when and where, and I'll come for a little bit. So I think that kind of covers it. Any questions?
Can I ask something?
Yes.
Okay, so we won't start parenting next week. Next week will just be a, we'll talk about, I do want to talk a little bit next week about the concept of romance, since it's, I mean, I got to at least tip a hat to the fact that it's Valentine's Day, right? And so I'll talk about the concept of romance in a little bit biblically, but, and then we're going to answer questions. Somebody's already asked, there's a debate coming in the Southern Baptist Convention about Calvinism, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that probably next week. And then, and then after that, if I remember correctly, is when we're going to do a few weeks on parenting. Questions? Yes, ma'am?
Spokesperson for it since I started it, and I don't. The website is at the seminary right now, and I have a personal email contact that I do with people. So if you're interested in further communication, I can give you my email. But I've been for the next month. I hopefully will be a little bit more busy giving presentations about the presentation.
Is that information like how would we find out
about the event?
Yes.
Yeah.
How can I get my nerdy husband to come see you again?
We have the link for the actual, it's how to register for the event, but it's that right, it says to register, you can visit, is that website still work, the EDU Hubble Narnia? So that's how you register, and then I think she wants to know where, will between now and then, will you be at any other locations that somebody could come?
Right now, no, I mean, I just not scheduled, we just started promoting, this just went public like last week, and so hopefully in the coming weeks I'll be doing this in other places.
Okay. He'll let me know, and you can email him directly or and get his email here in a minute or ask me, and we'll look for that kind of stuff. So let me pray, and we'll close out our time. Yes? Oh, yeah, pennies. The jar. Where'd the jar end up?
Well, you could take that. Whose pennies were they?
Actually, were the youth group pennies. We stole them from the youth group fundraiser. So here's the penny jar. So, okay. Father, we are so grateful for, once again, I love the fact that this is a church where we can do things kind of outside of the box a little bit. And I thank you, Lord, that once again, a church full of people, especially our leaders here, who are able to see once again that none of this is scary to you and doesn't need to be scary to us. Even if we're not into astrophysics, Lord, I just, you are, and you know all about it, and you put it into place, and you understand it, and we are still mostly, not quite completely in the dark about it. But as we've said so many times, it's not, we want to know the plan, but we don't have to know the plan. We just have to know that the person who wrote the plan has not forgotten us. And so, God, we find such peace in your grace and such freedom in your truth. And I pray that we will continue to learn to live more and more in your peace and truth every day through the power of your Spirit, according to the name of your Son and your perfect will, Father. We ask it. Amen.